Friends, those of us who are students of language in any way, whether our own language or a foreign language, whether we study it scientifically or from a literary point of view, we know from our own experience that very often it is the simplest words which are, I won't say the most difficult to understand, but certainly the most ambiguous. Take, for instance, the title of our talk this morning, Buddhism and Psychoanalysis. Now, what is meant by Buddhism, at least in a very general way, should have become clear in the course of the last few days, even for those who have had no previous connection or association with Buddhism. And as for this word psychoanalysis, we encounter it very often, we read about it, we hear it referred to in conversations, and when we listen to the radio, it's almost a household word. So we've got some general, even if rather imprecise, idea about what is meant by psychoanalysis. So here are two words out of the three words in our title disposed of. We've got some idea of what Buddhism means, some idea of what psychoanalysis means, but the title of the talk is Buddhism and Psychoanalysis. So what is the significance of this very little but highly ambiguous word, and? Obviously, some kind of comparison, some kind of contrast between Buddhism and psychoanalysis is intended. But why should one want to compare these two things, these two fields of knowledge? Why should one feel impelled to contrast them? We may say that we make the attempt, we make the effort to compare things in this way only when their existence constitutes for us a sort of problem. And it is the desire for the solution of this problem that constitutes the motive for the comparison. Now let me explain what I mean a little bit more in detail. Many of you know that from 1944 to 1964 I was in the East, mainly in India, and especially for the last 12 or 13 years of my sojourn there, in the Indo-Tibetan borderlands, more specifically in Kalimpong and in Darjeeling. And during the course of my stay in the East, I was occupied with the study of Eastern religions and philosophies, especially, of course, Buddhism, both on the theoretical and on the practical side. And as my studies progressed, as I became also a little more experienced, I took up a certain amount of preaching and teaching activity. While I was in Kalimpong, for instance, frequently going down into the plains at least once a year and engaging, I may say, in rather marathon sort of preaching tours all over the length and breadth of that vast subcontinent. But one of the things I found, not only when I was staying in Kalimpong, not only when I was out on tour, but all the time, I found in India that people used to come to me with their problems of various kinds. Now, these problems were usually quite ordinary, one may say, quite mundane. Many people used to come to me in those days with domestic problems. Either their son wouldn't study, and had, according to their idea, to be made to study. So an irate father would come and say, well, the boy has stopped going to school, I'm sending him to you tomorrow morning, please make him realize he must study. And this was the attitude. In the East, your parents are a little bit sort of stern, a little bit strict. And the idea of discussing the question with the son or the daughter just doesn't arise. They're just being told what they have to do. And very often the parent wants you to get my cooperation. And his idea was that I should put the full force of my authority behind this demand that the son should go back to school and study, because that is the high road to a government job, which is the sort of nirvana of modern Indian life nowadays. And sometimes, of course, they come with their matrimonial problems of various kinds. Either husband would come and complain about the wife, or wife would come and complain about the husband, and one would have to sort out various things, or you'd find someone who got mixed up with two or three wives, and quite a lot of sorting out was required, and adjust their various claims and all that sort of thing. And sometimes, though not so often, I must say, psychological problems. These came up very rarely. And sometimes people would come with spiritual problems, though these were rarest of all. Most of the people who came with just ordinary human problems, domestic problems, and things of that sort. So it was my practice, it was my habit, my custom in India to help out as best I could and give advice. And in this way, I think I may say, I developed quite an insight into different aspects of worldly life with which I had no direct personal connection. But I must say that during this whole period that I was in the East studying Buddhism and other Eastern religions and philosophies, practicing meditation, I had very little contact with psychology, that is to say, with modern psychology. I knew about it, of course, in a general way. I had some rather vague general idea about it, but I never gave psychology, and of course I mean Western psychology, modern psychology, any serious thought. In the East, one gets along without psychology, I would say, quite well. Buddhism, as you probably know, has its own system of what we would call psychology, and in the Buddhist countries they usually manage quite well with this, without any help from any of the various systems of modern psychology. But after I returned to this country, or rather after I paid my first visit to this country, beginning August 1964, the situation, so far as I was personally concerned, rather changed. And this change came about in a quite natural sort of manner. Almost from the day of my arrival in this country, here too, people started coming to me with their problems. For instance, people often ring me up and they would say, could I come and see you, please? There's a problem I want to discuss with you, or there's a difficulty I want to talk to you about. So just as in India, so in this country, people came with problems of various kinds. But I started noticing a difference. Hardly anybody came with any domestic problem or anything of that sort. Nearly everybody came with psychological problems. I would say 9 out of 10 of the people who came to consult me came not to ask so much about Buddhism, not because they were concerned about a particular problem of Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist thought. They came to ask for advice and help about their own psychological problems. Usually, they started off by telling the story of their lives. Sometimes it was a long and interesting story, sometimes it was a long and not so interesting story. Some would go into very great detail, others would just mention a few salient facts. But most people who came in this way with these psychological problems would tell the story of their lives. So I naturally used to listen patiently, take it all in, make a few mental notes, and gradually I could see two facts emerging. Not only emerging, one might say, even sort of jumping up and calling, even clamoring for attention. The first thing that struck me, the first fact that impressed me, was the very large number of people who were mentally and emotionally disturbed in this country. This is the first fact that emerged. I think I would say quite definitely that the percentage of mentally and emotionally disturbed people is much higher in this country, probably in the West as a whole, than it is in the East. In the East, people seem, on the whole, though there are exceptions, much more relaxed, much more emotionally and mentally balanced than they very often are here, especially in the big cities. So this is the first fact which emerged, which dawned, or perhaps even flashed upon me in the months that followed my return to this country, namely the very large number of people in modern society in the West who are mentally and emotionally disturbed, sometimes very seriously, in one way or another. The second fact which emerged was how many of these people coming to me had at one time or other been psychoanalyzed, some following a Freudian analysis, and I very quickly picked up these terms. Someone had a Freudian analysis, someone had a Jungian analysis, someone had existentialist analysis, and so on. But an extraordinarily large number seem to have had analysis at some time or another, or were even still having it. Some had had it for months, some had had it for 2 or 3 years, and one woman I remember who came to me, she claimed the record, she'd been having analysis and was still having it for 17 years, 2 or 3 times a week. And she didn't seem noticeably better as far as I could see. That's not, I'm sure, the fault of psychoanalysis, but that is how it did seem to be. Now, in India, and perhaps India is in advance of many Eastern countries, in India, psychoanalysis is available only in 2 or 3 of the big cities, probably Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, very likely not available or not very easily available elsewhere. So one can see from this that psychoanalysis plays a quite insignificant part in the life of people in India, in fact in the East generally. But in the West, certainly in this country, it became obvious to me after my return, psychoanalysis plays a very important part indeed. To parry the words of a well-known advertisement, psychoanalysis is in our life and part of it. And I think we have to accept that situation. And I think that nobody in this country who is concerned in any way with the teaching of whether Buddhism or any other religious system can possibly ignore the presence and the influence here of what we call psychoanalysis. So thus it happened that within some months of my return to this country in 64, I started thinking about, started turning over in my mind the connection, the relation between these two. On the one hand, Buddhism, and on the other hand, psychoanalysis. So this morning, I'm doing no more than sharing with you some of my thoughts on this particular subject. Obviously, it's a very vast and a very complex subject, one which one cannot fully explore in the course of an hour or so. One can't even attempt a proper introduction to such an exploration. In the first place, Buddhism itself, which is a very ancient tradition, contains hundreds of different schools of thought, and they don't always speak with the same voice. There's Theravada Buddhism, current in Ceylon, Burma and Thailand. There's the Mahayana, the Zen, there's Tibetan Buddhism. There are all these great major forms of Buddhism, and also their various subdivisions. They represent different aspects of the total Buddhist tradition, say metaphysical aspect, psychological aspect, ethical aspect, and so on. But we have in Buddhism this vast plethora of schools, teaching the same basic things, but with many important differences of emphasis and so on. Now, psychoanalysis is, of course, a very much younger movement. Whereas Buddhism is 2,500 years old, psychoanalysis was started by Freud only about the beginning of this century. So it's not even 100 years old. But already, there are quite a number of different versions of psychoanalysis. We know that in the case of Buddhism, within a century of the Buddha's passing away, 18 schools sprang up. 18 schools of Buddhism came into existence within the 100 years immediately following the Buddha's death. Now, almost as many schools of psychoanalysis developed in Freud's own lifetime. First of all, there's Jung and his analytical psychology. There's Adler and his individual psychology. And at present, there are orthodox Freudians. So the psychoanalytical movement has developed its own orthodoxy, you see, and various kinds of what are called neo-Freudians or revisionist Freudians. We've also got the humanistic type of psychoanalysis and the existentialist type of psychoanalysis. And in addition to these, there are the schools of, for instance, Henry Stack Sullivan, of Eric Fromm, and Karen Horney. So obviously, when you've got so many types, so many schools of Buddhism on the one hand, so many types, so many schools of psychoanalysis on the other, it's not possible to make a detailed comparison between the two systems, Buddhism and psychoanalysis, in the time at our disposal. We can only speak in very general terms indeed, and just get some idea of the subject in a very broad way, in very, very bare outline. So all that I propose to do this morning, or to attempt to do, is to compare what we may call basic Buddhism with basic psychoanalysis. By basic Buddhism I mean the body of teachings common to all the different schools, and by basic psychoanalysis I mean principles common to the orthodox Freudians, to the Jungians, the Adlerians, the Neo-Freudians, and so on. And I hope that in this way, those who are more interested in Buddhism may be stimulated to study a little of psychoanalysis, and those who are perhaps more interested in psychoanalysis may be stimulated to go a little more deeply into Buddhism.